Thank you, everybody. Welcome to this very exciting lunch debate over the constitutionality of the individual mandate in the National Health Insurance Bill, which was passed recently. All of you know that there has been much public debate and discussion over whether the healthcare mandate is constitutional, and we are lucky today to have two longtime friends of the Federalist Society who are going to debate the constitutionality of the mandate. First, we will hear from Professor Randy Barnett of the Georgetown Law School, who will make a case against the mandate, and then from Professor Orrin Kerr at GW Law School. They will each speak for 10 minutes, and then they will each have 5 minutes of time for rebuttal, after which I'll ask a question or two and then open it up to the floor for additional questions. So let's begin with Professor Barnett.
Well, thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me here. Thanks to all of you for coming. I can see there might be a little bit of interest in this issue. We might have had a bigger room. But it's a pleasure to be here. It's a little difficult, actually, to make an actual serious constitutional argument of this magnitude in 10 minutes. But I'll do the best I can to sketch it. And basically, I think that when we talk about the constitutionality or unconstitutionality of anything, that's mine, so don't take that away. Thank you. All right, so. That's, of course, the first thing young kids learn. You know, it's mine. It's mine. Right? So when we talk about the constitutionality or unconstitutionality of any measure, there are really three different ways in which we law professors speak of constitutionality, and it's very important that we keep these things distinct, or we're likely to be talking past one another. The first sense of constitutionality is what the Constitution says about the matter. It's somewhat an archaic way of looking at constitutionality, I admit, but it's still out there, and occasionally on cases of first impression, let's say, even courts may look at the Constitution. And the second sense of constitutionality is what the Supreme Court has said about whether a measure is constitutional. And then the third sense of constitutionality is whether you can predict that there are five votes amongst the Supreme Court to uphold or strike down some measure. And each one of these is actually a valid way of talking about constitutionality under the circumstances, whatever, depending on what point you're trying to make. But it's really important that we not talk past one another with respect to which sense we mean. Now, in the 9.5 minutes I have left, I'm not going to be addressing the first sense of constitutionality, that is, whether the Constitution itself allows the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, or the individual mandate. For one reason is because it's so obviously unconstitutional, according to the actual Constitution, that it really wouldn't be a fair fight. I actually don't think Orrin would have accepted the invitation to debate me if that had been the debate question. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, of course, it's not at issue in this litigation. Nobody who's litigating this case, and nothing that I have said about this case, is dependent on the original meaning of the Constitution or any other meaning of the Constitution itself. And I'm not going to say too much about Category 3, whether you can count to five votes. I have opinions about that. I do think, by the way, most people's views of counting to five votes have changed for the last year. I just took a survey of law professors over at the AALS, and I said when this thing started, how many of you thought this case was frivolous and had no chance of success? And virtually everyone in the audience raised their hand. And then I asked, and now how many people think this case has absolutely no chance or virtually no chance of success? And maybe 20% of the people raised their hand. So the public perception of the five votes has changed a lot. But this is because, in fact, of what's going on in Category 2 about the doctrine. It turns out that there is doctrine to be applied here. And under the existing doctrine, what Congress is doing is unprecedented. And first of all, what is Congress doing? Congress is mandating or requiring that every person in the United States engage in economic activity, in a particular kind of economic activity, that is, enter into a private contract with a private company, an insurance company. And this is something that has never been done in the history of the country before. Now, there are other kinds of mandates that have been done. If I had longer, we could talk about what they're like, but I can just prove to you that there's no precedent for economic mandates, because if there were, if Congress had exercised its Commerce Clause power, power in this way. Every person in this room, most of, I mean, I assume all of you are residents of the United States, most of you are citizens of the United States, and every person in this room would know all the economic mandates that you had to conform your conduct to in the course of your lifetime. And you know of none because there are none, and your parents didn't have to, and your grandparents didn't have to. I mean, you do have to file a tax return. You do have to register for the Selective Service. There are some mandates that, if you think about it, you're aware of, but these, that there is no economic mandate. It's never been done before. So given that, we immediately would sort of, if it's never been tried before, we happen to know that there's no case that directly says you can do this. So right off the bat, you have a problem with justifying this under existing Supreme Court doctrine. It would require some new decision which allows something that hasn't been done before to be done, perhaps because of the logical extension of previous cases. Of course, that's the way things are, that's the way con law is done. But there isn't any direct precedent that allows this. And that would really ought to be enough for lower courts, frankly. I mean, at this point, when we're talking about what lower courts ought to be doing, this really should decide the matter. I mean, I don't think lower courts should be authorizing new powers for Congress that the Supreme Court hasn't previously authorized when there is no precedent for that on which they can rely. But putting that to one side, obviously the Supreme Court is always free and by the way, it's really difficult to debate with Eugene in the Volokh in the front row because Eugene is rather expressive. So you know, everything I say is like it's a smile, it's a frown, it's a furrowed brow, it's a you can't be serious about this.
Thanks, Eugene.
He's like a silent heckler, right? And he's even red-faced now. So okay. But anyway, where was I? No precedent. Okay. Let's talk about the precedent there is for something like this. The precedent that's been relied on. What precedent does exist? First of all, there's the Commerce Clause precedent, right? And in fact, this isn't really, strictly speaking, a Commerce Clause case at all, because the Commerce Clause part of this case is the regulation of the insurance companies, and that probably violates the original meaning of the Constitution as well, but is not even being challenged here, because the case of Southeastern Underwriters decided in 1944, you know, a great year for Supreme Court decisions, a great era, said that the regulation of insurance companies, insurance, the business of insurance is within the commerce power. It is commerce, and therefore, no one's really challenging that. No one is challenging that because under existing doctrine, this is not a subject question. Oh, I know what I wanted to say. The relationship of doctrine and outcomes. I do think doctrine is important, and this is the example I give for why it's important. It's simply no matter what the politics of this case are, that challenge is not going to work because no one believes that the court will reconsider Southeastern Underwriters, no matter what the politics are. So doctrine there works against the politics. Supposing the political objections to this bill made it very unpopular and the court would be willing to overturn it, there are 5 votes to overturn it, I don't think that would be a way to do it because the doctrine is so clear. But if there are 5 votes to overturn the law, that's Category 3 of constitutionality, then, and the doctrine is not very clear, or in fact there is no doctrine that currently exists to justify it, well, then we're talking about a different ballgame. And I think that's the ballgame we're talking about with the individual mandate. So what is the relevant doctrine that currently governs the Commerce Clause, but not just the Commerce Clause, but the Necessary and Proper Clause, which the government has stressed heavily as a justification for this exercise of power? And those of you know, the Necessary and Proper Clause says that Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers here or elsewhere in the Constitution, including the Commerce Clause power. Well, the supporters of this bill make a simple argument, which I have to say that in initial stages of this litigation, I thought had a lot more power than I currently think it does, and that is that, well, if Congress has the power to regulate the insurance companies, as Southeastern Underwriter says, and the mandate is necessary to the regulation of insurance companies, and we generally defer to Congress with respect to what's necessary, then obviously this is constitutional. And by the way, I think if there are 5 votes to uphold the mandate, that's generally speaking, I think, the way the opinion is going to go. That's the reason why the tax power argument that you may have heard of is never going to be part of this case, because there is this other way of doing it, and there's all these problems with doing it the tax. Oh, my God, 2 more minutes. I haven't even gotten to the doctrine yet. All right, focus. All right, so There is a doctrine. This is the little secret. There is a doctrine that currently exists that actually specifies the boundaries of the necessary and proper clause in the context of the Commerce Clause, and it's called the substantial effects doctrine. Now, you've all heard of the substantial effects doctrine. It's a doctrine that originated in the New Deal cases of NLRB, Darby, and Wickard, and was carried forward and then limited in the cases of Lopez and Morrison, which provided a limit to that doctrine. It's not normally thought of as a necessary and proper clause doctrine because Chief Justice Rehnquist and Lopez didn't call it that. He called it Commerce Clause. And that's, I think, why Judge Hudson in the Virginia case also called it Commerce Clause. He was just mirroring the Supreme Court. But when the doctrine was first devised and promoted, it was justified not under the Commerce Clause, but under the Necessary and Proper Clause. The Fair Labor Relations Act, which was upheld in Darby, had two provisions that were under issue. And the first issue was whether Congress could regulate goods that were made from labor that had been paid below a certain wage that crossed state lines. And they said, of course they can do that. Commerce Clause, authority for that, Gibbons versus Ogden. But then the question is, could they order manufacturers to pay wages? That's manufacturing when they're making goods that might go into interstate commerce. And they said, yes, they can do that too. Authority, because it has a substantial effect on interstate commerce, authority for that, McCulloch versus Maryland. That was a necessary and proper clause justification of the substantial effects doctrine. And then that doctrine, that necessary and proper clause doctrine, was then limited in Lopez and Morrison to reaching interest, for the first time, to reach interstate activity that has an economic nature and not a non-economic nature. Okay, now I have to stop. But I'm going to take an extra minute, I'm sorry, because I think it's important, to talk about the only authority that the government relies on in order to justify this extension of power beyond the framework that's provided by NLRB, Darby, Wickard, Lopez, and Morrison, and the civil rights cases, Heart of Atlanta, this whole line of cases. They rely on, it's kind of ironic, a concurring opinion by Justice Scalia, Antonin Scalia, in the Gonzalez versus Raich case, a case that's near and dear to my heart, an opinion that's nearer and dearer to my heart. Of course, it's gotten dearer to my heart recently. And this is a doctrine that Justice Scalia announced based on dictum that it's Lopez, and that's Justice Scalia says that Congress can reach even intrastate non-economic activity when doing a broader regulatory scheme. And the government, the statute itself relies on that reasoning in the findings of the statute. Now, let me just say this about that case. Number one, it's not the law. It is a concurring opinion by one justice. So it might be the law. In fact, I predict that in the Wright case, it will be the law. I think it's a principle that the court is open to, amenable to, and will adopt in the Wright case. This is not that case, but in some future case, they will adopt it. Secondly, it is a necessary and proper clause theory. But in the very same opinion in which Justice Scalia identifies this theory, he calls the substantial effects doctrine also a necessary and proper clause doctrine as well, which is limited by the economic-non-economic distinction. So this theory that you're hearing from me today, I don't have to write a brief to the Supreme Court to explain this to them. Justice Scalia already knows this theory. He wrote this in his concurring opinion. So then the only question is, if the court decided to adopt one day this essential to a broader regulatory scheme exception or alternative to the substantial effects doctrine, would they do so in a limited fashion or in an unlimited fashion? And I think the answer is, given to us in Lopez, that if you do it in an unlimited fashion, that essentially gives the government a police power, so there must be, that doctrine must have a limit. What would that limit be? Well, the limit is suggested in Justice Scalia's opinion itself when he uses the word activity or activities 42 times in that opinion. In other words, the natural limit is that Congress can reach intrastate activity when doing so is essential to a broader regulatory scheme, but what it may not do is mandate activity, reach inactivity. That would be a line it cannot cross. Why would that be a convenient line for the court to draw? Well, there's some substantive reasons in favor of it, which I don't have time to go into, but I will just suggest that it's a line that the court would be very comfortable drawing because it's a rule of law that would affect one and only one law that's ever been passed in the history of this country, and that is the Affordable Care Act. And I think the court would be very comfortable drawing a line saying Congress may not go where until 2010 it has never decided to go before. It has always had adequate powers elsewhere in the Constitution to accomplish its goals, including health care, which if Medicare is constitutional, then Medicare for everyone is constitutional, and it could pass a single-payer plan if it wanted to. If it has the votes to do so. And if it doesn't have the votes to do so, well, that's what the political process is for. So on that grounds, I think, because existing doctrine does not currently recognize the constitutionality of this mandate, I think there's a good argument for why it is why Congress should not be given this new power that it's never exercised before, and there's a nice, neat doctrinal line to deny it. Thanks.
Thank you all for coming. It's a great honor to be here. It's a tremendous honor, first of all, to be debating with Randy Barnett, who is really the person. I think the New York Times, Randy, called you the intellectual godfather of the arguments against the individual mandate. Now, if an argument needs an intellectual godfather, I'm not sure how strong it is, but nonetheless, that is quite an honor for the New York Times to recognize that point. But seriously, Randy has done a tremendous amount of work, and accurately noting the shift in opinion as to the likely strengths of the challenges to the mandate. Randy noted how a few months ago this was considered a frivolous argument. Now a lot of people don't think it's frivolous, and the reason for that is Randy's arguments. So it really is magnificent, the work that he's done in changing perspectives and changing attitudes towards the Commerce Clause and the scope of federal power generally. With that said, I feel a little bit like a physician who's called to the scene of an accident and asked to evaluate the health of a patient. And the patient is in terrible shape. The patient is gasping for breath. The patient may not make it through the day. And they say, "Doctor, what do you think about the patient? We were hoping we were going to play volleyball this afternoon. You think we're going to do it?" And I think, "I'm really sorry, but the patient is not in good shape. I don't want the patient to be sick. I'd rather the patient be well. But the patient, it turns out, is sick." And the patient in this case is federalism. Under current Supreme Court doctrine, conservatives and libertarians have been complaining about the current state of federal-state power as determined by Supreme Court cases for many years, going back to Wickard versus Filburn and before that, under the view, which I think many in this room share, and I certainly do, that the Supreme Court has construed the scope of federal power far beyond what it should have been. And the difficulty is, if we now approach the question of whether the individual mandate is constitutional, if we take a look at those cases and take a look at those doctrines, I think the fairest reading of those cases and the fairest reading of those doctrines is that the individual mandate is constitutional. And I don't think it's that hard of an issue. I think actually, sadly, I'm not, again, not saying that I like this, but the current state of doctrine, both on the necessary and proper clause and on the Commerce Clause, are so broad that they pretty easily encompass the individual mandate. So there are two different theories, I think, that you can use to reach this. There's the necessary and proper clause or the Commerce Clause directly, the necessary and proper clause being an add-on to the Commerce Clause power. And let me just start with the necessary and proper clause. The most recent case on the necessary and proper clause is Comstock from just a few months ago, a case I suspect the justices were deciding with the individual mandate in mind. The Supreme Court said, "In determining whether the necessary and proper clause grants Congress the legislative authority to enact a particular federal statute, we look to see whether the statute constitutes a means that is rationally related to the implementation of a constitutionally enumerated power." Essentially, at least based on the majority opinion in Comstock, a rational basis test. Those of you in this room know how hard it is to satisfy a rational basis test. Now, there were concurring opinions. Justice Kennedy, for example, concurred in the judgment in Comstock, saying that he thinks it should be slightly higher than rational basis. But the majority opinion itself says just rational basis. And even if it's more than rational basis, I think it's pretty easy to see how the individual mandate satisfies the rational basis or rational basis with slight bite test for the following reason. Healthcare is about 1/8 of the United States economy. People spend tremendous amounts of money on healthcare. Hospital stays, doctor visits, tests, whatever it is, people spend a lot of money on it. It is a massive part of the United States economy. And in trying to reconfigure the healthcare market in the United States, this massive interstate market, Congress decided that they wanted to have a ban on pre-existing conditions for health insurance. And the way of enforcing that was having people who could pay for healthcare have to buy healthcare insurance in order to avoid people delaying having healthcare insurance until they get sick. So what Congress was worried about is if there's no ban on pre-existing conditions, you just wait until you have a pre-existing condition, because it's going to be much cheaper for you to do that. It's basically, imagine a regime of car insurance where you didn't have to get car insurance until you were in an accident. Well, you're going to wait until you get into an accident. Why have car insurance if you can just wait to have it? So Congress was worried that people were going to opt out of health insurance, raising the cost for everybody else, and that the ban on pre-existing conditions wasn't going to work. We can disagree on the merits of this legislation. In fact, most of the people in this room do. And I also disagree with the merits of this legislation from a public policy standpoint. But it seems to me that it is a rational decision to regulate that in order to alter the market in healthcare and health insurance. Healthcare is so much a part of the United States economy, and the decision to require people, or at least impose some sort of a fine for people who can purchase health insurance but don't, in order to ensure that the ban on pre-existing conditions is workable as part of this massive regulation of the United States economy. There are problems with it, but one of the problems with it is not its failure to be part of the interstate commerce, to be rationally related to the ban on going beyond interstate commerce. So I think straight from a necessary and proper clause perspective, that alone is enough to pretty straightforwardly allow this sort of a regulation. It is rationally related to the goal of regulating interstate commerce because it is so central to the United States economy, which is, of course, the reason why it is controversial for many people. The next argument would be, even if you don't accept the necessary and proper clause argument, does it satisfy the Commerce Clause itself? Randy suggests that actually the current state of Commerce Clause doctrine and the current state of necessary and proper clause doctrine are the same. I don't think that's correct under current law. I think it'd be a good way for the doctrine to go. But if you look at the Comstock case, for example, Comstock, this Supreme Court case from a few months ago, was about the federal power to hold people that were in federal prison that are sexually dangerous predators, not connected to any actual federal power, but the only connection to the federal government is that they were in federal prison before, and the Supreme Court said that's okay. We're far removed from the Commerce Clause test, I think. So I think the necessary and proper clause arguments and Commerce Clause arguments are distinct. On the Commerce Clause, I think it's helpful to start with Justice Thomas's dissent in Gonzalez versus Raich, here's how he begins his dissent. Respondents use marijuana that has never been bought or sold, that has never crossed state lines, and that has had no demonstrable effect on the national market for marijuana. If Congress can regulate this under the Commerce Clause, then it can regulate virtually anything, and the federal government is no longer one of limited and enumerated powers. I think Justice Thomas was basically right. That's not to say that the Raich case is correct, but if you accept Raich, there are very few limits on the scope of federal power. I think if you look at Morrison and you look at Lopez and Raich together, essentially what the cases say is if there's some purely symbolic limit on federal power that has nothing to do with economics, that has nothing to do with business, that has nothing to do with any sort of market, then that can exceed the scope of federal power. But if it does have to do with some sort of market, some have to do with something related to economics, then it is within the scope of federal power. So I think Justice Thomas was essentially correct that we have only these symbolic limits on the scope of federal power under the Commerce Clause. In terms of the distinction between activity and inactivity, which Randy proposes as a limitation on the scope of federal power, I don't think that can work in light of Wickard versus Filburn. So remember, in Wickard, Congress was limiting how much wheat a person could produce for purely personal use. And the goal Congress had was in trying to encourage people to purchase wheat in interstate commerce. They were trying to stimulate interstate commerce by limiting how much wheat people would have for personal purposes on their own farm, for example. The Supreme Court said, and I'm quoting here, "The stimulation of commerce is a use of the regulatory function quite as definitively as prohibitions or restrictions thereon." And it seems to me that if the stimulation of commerce, having people regulating in order to get people to engage in commerce, is the same as prohibiting commerce, then a distinction between activity and inactivity doesn't really work. The Wickard case seems to say that you can't sort of draw these artificial lines between encouraging something, discouraging something, action, inaction. I just don't think it's consistent with the line drawn in Wickard versus Filburn. And then I think it's also helpful to note that in Wickard, the court talks about these distinctions that had been established in Commerce Clause doctrine before Wickard, such as, for example, production would be considered different from manufacturing. There were direct and indirect effect, regulations on interstate commerce. And the Supreme Court in Wickard said we can't use the nomenclature. We shouldn't rely on the nomenclature. We have to have a much more functional approach as to what actually impacts interstate commerce. And so, again, I think if you take that as the view, I don't think we can introduce the distinction between activity and inactivity without running up against the guidance from Wickard versus Filburn that we should not be following these terms and the nomenclature as guiding the scope of federal power, but rather that we need to look at what's the actual impact on interstate commerce. So I don't think the activity-inactivity distinction really works, and I'm actually not entirely sure what it would mean. I teach criminal law, and there's a similar distinction between acts and omissions in criminal law. There's a requirement of a voluntary act. But courts really struggle with trying to figure out what an act is. What's an act versus an omission? When can omissions be prohibited? It's a very difficult line in the criminal law setting, and I'm not entirely sure what the proposed line would look at from the standpoint of Commerce Clause doctrine. I think the strength of the argument is the Supreme Court has said, you can do anything you want, and it's always talked about activities. And so a way around that is to say, well, this is not activity, this is inactivity. But I just don't think that the language of Wickard will really support that kind of line. So unfortunately, I end up in a position that I don't much like, but I think the cases seem to require, which is that the individual mandate is constitutional either because it is necessary and proper as part of an effort to regulate interstate commerce, or that it's just a more direct regulation of interstate commerce based on the current state of constitutional law. Will the Supreme Court change that doctrine? They might, and I think most of us in this room think that they should, and I'm pretty sympathetic to that myself. But based on current law, I don't think the individual mandate is unconstitutional. Thank you.
Well, if there are five votes to uphold on this mandate under like the third way of dealing with constitutionality, and Justice Breyer gets to write the opinion, I think Orrin's pretty well described what Justice Breyer would say. So, good job, Justice Breyer. And that is basically that you know Congress can do whatever it wants. I mean, Justice Breyer dissented in all those Commerce Clause cases, and he made that argument consistently in dissent as it was being rejected. For example, he objected to the formal distinction between economic and non-economic activity on the grounds that we've left those formal distinctions behind. And nevertheless, I think Orrin would admit that the distinction between economic and non-economic activity, though it be formal and categorical and not a direct assessment of necessity and propriety directly, is a limitation on the commerce power, and also I believe it's a limitation on the Necessary and Proper Clause, and so does Justice Scalia. So the question is there any compelling cases? I mean, Orrin relies on a line in Wickard versus Filburn. Wickard versus Filburn was an obvious case of activity. Roscoe Filburn was engaged in commercial farming. He had a major commercial farm. In fact, the statute itself exempted small commercial farms. And he was engaged in commercial farming, and he decided to evade the supply constraints that was being imposed to raise the cost of wheat for everyone in order to help some farmers out, to restrict the supply of wheat, so you couldn't grow more than a certain amount of wheat. And he decided to feed his own cattle the wheat that he was growing, and then send his cattle out to market as a way of staying within the limits and using the other wheat on the farm, not for his own personal consumption. That's somewhat of a law professor's myth. He was using it on the farm as well as, you know, baking bread with it himself. So Wickard versus Filburn is a consummate case of activity. It didn't use the distinction between economic and non-economic activity. No previous case had done that until Lopez and then Morrison reaffirmed it. So that was, and how did Chief Justice Rehnquist go about that? He looked back and he said, look, this substantial effects doctrine has to have a limit. If it doesn't have a limit, there's a general police power. And if we look back, all the previous cases that previously have been decided have involved economic activity, so there's a limit. Previous cases had not said that, but now Chief Justice Rehnquist did. The same thing will be true when the new doctrine, the essential to a broader regulatory scheme, is ever decided to be applied to a case. Justice Scalia, who was the principal proponent of that doctrine, and who was in the dissenting opinion in Comstock, I should remind you, will have an obvious distinction that he can employ that's similar to the economic, non-economic distinction. It's the activity, inactivity distinction, which happens to be a distinction that only a law professor could fail to understand. I mean, you really have to go to law school to learn that there's a difference, that there is no difference between acting and failing to act. In fact, most of the problems, by the way, that are caused by that distinction for law professors has to do with the consequences of failing to act being the same as the consequences for acting. But you would almost have to be insane to believe there's no actual difference in the real world between punching someone in the nose and failing to punch someone in the nose, as though they're the same thing. So, and they're both equally acts. So at any rate, I mean, so there are problematic policy reasons for making that distinction, but the distinction itself is pretty basic. All right, let me say a few words about Comstock, then I'll sit down. Comstock is a very bad case. I wrote an amicus brief on the other side of Comstock. I was in court for the oral argument in Comstock, and the court was very troubled by Comstock, by having to rule in that case. They wish they hadn't done it. They didn't have to do it. First of all, I want to say Comstock is not a Commerce Clause case. So to the extent this is a necessary and proper to the exercise of the commerce power, the court, it's not really a Commerce Clause case. It was a case about a very special problem, and this is slightly talking about Category 3 of constitutionality here, about a very special problem, which was what to do with federal prisoners who are dangerous, and then what did the federal government do when it comes time to release those prisoners, and then states don't want to take them back. Then what happens? They don't want to take them back and deal with them as sexually dangerous people. And that clearly was bothering the justices in oral argument. It was reflected in the opinions, and they felt there was, and therefore in the doctrine, in that opinion, they put in a five-part test or a five considerations or five factors, whatever you want to call them, three of which, and I believe with this potential challenge in mind, three of which at least don't, the mandate, this bill does not qualify under. One of them has to do with a long history involvement in a particular area, which was federal incarceration, and also the treatment of mentally ill patients. The second was this was simply a somewhat small addition to the previous regime. And thirdly, it had allowed an opt-out for states, so there was a minimal intrusion on federalism principles. Now, I believe, first of all, Justice Kennedy did not join that opinion, as Orrin told you. He argued for a heightened rational basis scrutiny in Commerce Clause cases, which was interesting because he'd never said a word in Raich about what he thought about that. And now we know that he's a little nervous about this. Justice Alito didn't join that opinion. And very significantly, I think, Justice Scalia joined Justice Thomas's originalist dissent in that opinion, which is something he'd never done before in the Commerce Clause or Necessary and Proper Clause arena, signaling, I believe, that he is not amenable to this extension of the Necessary and Proper Clause. And if his theory in Raich is the theory on which the government is hanging its hat, I wouldn't be super confident that Justice Scalia will be the government's champion in this case. So for all those reasons, because the doctrine of Comstock can easily be distinguished, oh, one last thing about the possible reason why that's true, the fifth vote for the opinion, it was a 7-2 decision, but the fifth vote for the opinion was provided by Chief Justice Roberts. And one might surmise, because one doesn't know, that those five limiting factors that were included into that opinion were necessary. This is Justice Breyer writing the opinion. He certainly doesn't care about those five limiting factors. But those five limiting factors might well have been necessary to attract and maintain the chief's vote on that opinion. And therefore, it would be up to the chief to distinguish Comstock on the basis of the five factors that might have been put there to satisfy him in the first place.
Randy, I want to push you, if I can, on the activity-inactivity distinction. Because you say, and we've debated this, you've always said it's very simple. And then I offer a bunch of hypotheticals, and then I haven't heard back from you how you would treat the hypothetical. So if it's very simple, I'm assuming you'll be able to very quickly and easily answer how the activity-inactivity distinction would apply to a couple simple cases. One is, instead of saying any person has to purchase the health insurance, any person who breathes has to purchase health insurance, any person who exercises has to purchase health insurance, any person who crosses interstate lines has to purchase health insurance. I could go on. Any person who visits the doctor, any person who visits the dentist, any person who purchases aspirin has to purchase health insurance. In any of those cases, are those regulations of action, activity? I think non-law professors would say they're all activity. But do we instead say, well, if you take that view, then it really is gutting the activity and activity distinction. So you can't take that view. So we're going to require a certain amount of action. Are we going to require some amount of nexus between the action and interstate commerce, or is it just something that counts as an act? Is it something that is beyond just human action? Is it a voluntary action? Where exactly is the line drawn? I'd love to know your answers to those questions. And then also, I think the Comstock case, remember that's the case involving a detention of people that are in federal prison after their sentences have run out. First, I think we can agree there's no, if you have an action-inaction distinction, there's no action in Comstock. So someone is in prison, they're supposed to be set free, and then they're acted upon again. They're regulated. They haven't done anything. They're just wanting to get out of prison. So there's clearly no action in Comstock. The great majority of individuals that are in federal prison are in federal prison for conviction of crimes enacted under the Commerce Clause. A lot of them are for narcotics, which is part of the Commerce Clause, fraud, interstate fraud. Most people, I guess immigration would be an example that's not part of the Commerce Clause, but the majority are in federal prison under the Commerce Clause. So I don't think it's so easy to look at Comstock and say, well, that has nothing to do with interstate commerce, because in fact, in that case, the issue was whether the federal power was necessary and proper as part of a series of federal criminal laws, most of which in practice were Commerce Clause laws. So I'd like to know if there's action in Comstock, breathing, exercising, visiting the dentist, and crossing interstate lines. Thanks.
Well, let me say, the reason why, Oren, I don't answer your hypothetical questions is because I'm a law professor and my business is asking hypothetical questions, not answering your hypothetical questions. So, some of them I don't answer because, you know, I think they're just, they make my head hurt. They're kind of insane. But the others that are, others are not. I mean, but the, you can find activity. You can condition, some of your hypotheticals involve conditioning regulations on an activity that you found. Well, now you clearly accept the distinction between activity or inactivity, or you wouldn't be posing the hypotheticals you are.
So no, I'm saying what is the distinction?
Well, first of all, the format was you answer, I answer, and then we go to questions. Since you posed, now I'm up again because you decided to ask me some hypothetical questions, and I'm answering it as best I can. We'll let the audience decide if it's satisfactory or not. So in every of the examples that you give, you identify activity. You have the activity of purchasing aspirin, the activity of exercising. You must understand that as activity because that's why you're posing the hypotheticals. You have the activity of breathing. But that's problematic. I mean, this is why I don't answer your hypotheticals, because the activity of breathing, first of all, it's an involuntary act, and the whole act omission. Try. Just try to stop. All right. So, actually, whoever made that sound, I wish you would. Oh, Richard. Sorry, I didn't know it was you. I take it back. I didn't know it was you, Richard. Yeah, keep on breathing as long as possible. We all want you to breathe. That sort of illustrates the lengths of you have to go to deny the distinction. I mean, because it's an involuntary act, and essentially saying, look, if breathing is an activity, living is an activity, and therefore we can condition your life on you doing what we tell you to do. Well, that is a totalitarian power. I mean, that is like saying, because the government has the power to draft you, which is essentially the power to enslave you, and there's an exception, and how it got around the 13th Amendment in order to do that is kind of instructive, and I'll say that in a second. But because the government has the power to draft or enslave you, it has the power to do anything to you as a human being because you're breathing. That is not a power the government's ever claimed before. The power to draft, by the way, was justified as not subject to the 13th Amendment and the Selective Service cases on the grounds that you have a fundamental duty of citizenship to help defend the country that's protecting you and giving you the rights that you have as citizens in return. Now, you would have to argue that there's a principle also in the Constitution, and that, by the way, that's an interesting principle. I mean, it has been recognized. But you'd have to argue that there's a fundamental duty of citizenship to do anything Congress wants that it in its has a rational basis for concluding is related to the regulation of interstate commerce. I don't believe that you can show that there's such a fundamental duty of citizenship. But that is what the implication. It's interesting because the implication of accepting this proposition is that there is such a duty. And that really fundamentally changes the relationship of citizen to state. It really means we are no longer free citizens. We are subjects of the government. The Constitution does make a distinction between citizens and subjects. It refers to American citizens as citizens, and it refers to foreign subjects. So it knows there's a difference, and we are not subjects, but we would be subjects if the government has the power to mandate that we do everything. So forget the activity and activity distinction if that's hurting you, if that hurts your head. And just go back to basics. In the history of this country, has the government ever used the Commerce Clause combined with the Necessary and Proper Clause to mandate economic activity? Not to tell you how to engage in activity you've chosen to engage in, like farming or running a hotel or doing any of the myriad other things that we do the government tells us how to do or stops us from doing. But has in the history of this country the federal government ever used its Commerce Clause and Necessary and Proper Clause to impose economic mandates on the people? You would know if the answer to that was yes. Therefore, you know that the answer is no, and therefore, this is unprecedented. It would need new doctrine to justify it, and there may be 5 votes to uphold it, but then I think there may not be.
I just wanted to very briefly respond. As I understand it, the action-inaction distinction is nothing that simple at all, because the concepts, Randy, that you turned to were ones of political theory. The nature of totalitarianism, the nature of the relationship between the individual and the state. And if that's what governs the action inaction, or informs us as to what counts as action and inaction, that does not strike me as a simple distinction, but actually a quite complicated one. Maybe it should be adopted, but it's certainly not a simple distinction. It's actually quite a complicated one.
So I have a question for Oren, and then a question for Randy, and then I was going to open it up to the floor. My question for Oren is, if Congress can compel us under the Necessary and Proper and Commerce Clauses to buy things and to enter into the market, which it's never done before, can Congress also ban inactivity, which such as loafing or being a couch potato, which is demonstrably harmful to your health? Can Congress require that everyone exercise for 30 minutes a day because that clearly benefits your health? Can Congress require that all of us donate blood because, after all, there is a need for blood donations? Can Congress require people with 2 kidneys who don't really need the second one to donate to blood-compatible donors? Is there any limit on what Congress can do if you go beyond the notion that the commerce power extends to buying and selling that's already underway?
Right. So I gather when you're asking, can Congress do this, you're not asking, is it constitutional, or saying, would it extend beyond the Commerce Clause power? So we're talking about things that we're all going to accept that states can do, and the only issue is whether the federal government can do it.
Is there enumerated power for the federal government to do this, such that the only way that you can protect your right to loaf or not to exercise or not to give blood is by asserting some sort of individual right, substantive due process type right, that you can't be compelled to do that? Is there a limit on enumerated powers in that respect?
I read the cases, in particular the sort of Lopez-Morrison Raich line, as suggesting that the key line is whether the conduct, when considered in the aggregate, is part of an economic scheme. So exercise, I don't think, is part of an economic scheme. Granted, you can make the chain. If you keep going out, eventually you get there. But we know under Commerce Clause doctrine, you can't make that long a connection. So I would say they could, under existing doctrine, again, I'm not saying I like this, but this is just my read of the doctrine, Congress could force an economic transaction, but they can't force a non-economic transaction.
And then my question for Randy is, the individual mandate is, as Oren mentioned, driven by the fact that the legislation forbids insurance companies from taking account of pre-existing conditions. Hasn't Congress, by adopting the individual mandate and banning the taking account of pre-existing conditions, hasn't Congress effectively engaged in a massive taking of all of our organs and bodily parts, in essence, whereby suddenly we're all responsible for each other's kidneys and other potential organ failures rather than simply responsible for my own? In other words, is there a massive taking implied when people who are healthy and have no pre-existing condition are made responsible as a result of no activity of their own for the pre-existing conditions of other people?
Richard says to say yes, so I'll say yes. There's takings, and then there's constitutionally cognizable takings, and the mandate itself is a taking. The mandate itself is a take. I'm not saying the current takings clause doctrine would recognize it as a taking, but it's literally a taking from all the citizens and giving to the insurance companies. Congress has a taxing power that it can use to solve free rider problems and to adopt social welfare legislation. It's done it before. It's Social Security exercise of taxing power, Medicare, Medicaid. They're all tax power associated cases, and that's how Congress solves problems of free riders. If it's going to mandate that private individuals or private insurance companies have to serve people, it can compensate those people. The public can compensate those people by the tax power system, which is how they always do it. They try to do an end run around, but there is a problem with it using the tax power for this purpose. It has this power for this purpose, and it may use it for this purpose, but there's a constraint on that power, and the constraint is political. And the way the political constraint operates is it has to be identified as a tax, and that can be voted up or down as a tax. And they had plans, the Congress had plans before it, which were tax power based, and it refused to enact them. And the reason why is obvious. It did not have the votes to impose a single payer plan, which is what most people who wanted reform favored. It did not have the votes to impose that plan, and so it decided to do an end run around the political constraints imposed on the tax power. So instead of using its tax power to take money and then dispensing it to the insurance companies, it decided just to transfer the money from your pocket directly to the insurance companies to evade the political constraint on the tax power itself. That is something that's unconstitutional. They have no power to do that, and they've never done it before. And if they're allowed to do it this time, then it's the golden goose, because now they can start taking from everybody to give to everybody else instead of having to take political responsibility for exercising their tax power.
Okay, questions from the audience. Richard.
Yeah, this is a question for Oren. Now, let me see if I can put the burden back on you in the following fashion. Your basic position is it's simply a matter of sort of small formal differences between the current mandate and a mandate which conditions the payment of this particular tax on breathing, going to the doctor, or something of the sort. So isn't the correct political solution to say, okay, it's just a formal decision, Randy's right, we strike this thing down, and now you go to this Congress rather than to the last Congress, and you go there and you draft your statute and figure out which activity you wish to make this conditional upon, and go through the entire political process,
because the conceptual distinction is clear. It's the political significance that doesn't matter. And so that what you really have done is made an argument that you could reenact most of what you want constitutionally rather than doing it by construction. So I think there's that. The second part of this question is, I think, implicit in the entire discussion, which is the unconstitutional conditions doctrine would then have to be fairly faced. And there is the questions of proportionality and relevance to this. And so if you decided that you wanted to make this thing conditional upon buying bubble gum at Kmart or something of that sort, would you meet whatever relatedness and germaneness tests are met on the other side so that we switch the fortune from one to the other? So the first question is, why not reenact it in the way in which you want it? And the second one is, if you did that, would you run into unconstitutional complications?
Yeah, I think... just to be clear, I'm not proposing the action-inaction distinction. I'm wondering what it is supposed to mean. So I don't think you need – I don't think that distinction exists in Commerce Clause doctrines.
Randy basically said, look, it's conceptually distinct and politically irrelevant. And I think the conceptual stuff is perfectly clear. Your argument is one of political irrelevance. Okay, if it's politically irrelevant, go back to Congress and do it the right way. And I don't think you can show me that punching somebody in the nose and not saving them when they're being punched by somebody else is identical. So don't try to, I'm not doing the political theory number. I'm not doing the citizenship number. I'm doing the straight, the ontological, conceptual number and saying...
Right, but you're asking me to talk about political tactics of a proposed distinction that I don't understand.
No, the distinction is perfectly clear, and you've given me thousands of ways in which you can get all that you want by observing it. My view is go to Congress and pick any one of them and get it through.
And then I guess if you're asking me what I'd want to do, what are my policy preferences? Because I would say don't do this. Okay, if I like the legislation and I want to keep it as is, why don't I just have Congress repass it? Other than the obvious political difficulties of doing that in the current Congress. I would ask Randy, what's the minimal amount of action?
He's a conceptual purist. Now, forget about the political theory. The question to you is, now you've given me five possibilities, right? I'm not asking you to distinguish amongst them. I say, pick the one that you want, put it in the bill, see if you can get it through, and then ask whether or not the unconstitutional conditions doctrine would make you look silly. That's the question you have to face, and you've not faced it.
And I don't know how to face it.
Well, that means you're wrong, right?
Okay, let's move on to another question. Eugene.
I'm just frowning at him while he talks at me. It stopped him too.
It did. I should do it more often. Looking at McCulloch and Maryland, it seems to me the logical way of avoiding the infinity problem, the problem that everything would be permitted, is to say, well, that there's something beyond mere always easily passable rational basis for the nexus required under the necessary property clause. There's got to be, it doesn't have to be strict necessity, but there's got to be some relatively sufficient connection. And I think the language of McCulloch v. Maryland fits that. I don't think the activity and activity distinction fits the language of McCulloch v. Maryland, but some requirement of some not necessarily tight but not very, very loose connection is sufficient. I think Orrin is quite right that adequate connection is present here. Now, to be sure, the tight connection versus very loose connection line is hard to administer. I've got to agree with that. But it seems to me if you look at McCulloch v. Maryland, you look at the language necessary and proper, it seems to me that Orrin's argument that this is necessary and proper to the regulation of interstate commerce is quite right. And if that's so, the conceptual answer, at least, query how well it'll work practically, but conceptually, at least the answer to the infinity problem is, well, In another case, such as the requirement that you donate a kidney or something like that, which I think is more a substantive due process thing, I think our reactions to it would be the same if the state required you to do that. The answer to that is, well, there the connection is too loose. And how do we know that we can administer that? Well, we did that in Lopez and Morrison, and we saw there the connection was too loose. And in Raich, there was a majority, perhaps wrong, but there was a majority of the proposition that the connection is tight enough. So it seems to me that that's the approach rather than the activity and activity level.
That's a really important question, I think, because I think it simply misstates how the Supreme Court has approached necessary and proper in McCulloch and since McCulloch. McCulloch stands for the proposition that when it comes to the convenience of a law, that's something that's a matter of legislative discretion, and the courts will not scrutinize the degree of necessity that a law has, what Hamilton, in his opinion on the bank, called the more or less necessity of something. So it's, in fact, the government's only limiting principle, not Orrin's. I don't know what Orrin's limiting principle is, but the government's limiting principle so far is health care is different. On the facts, health care is different from other markets, and that's why this would not give government an unlimited power, Congress an unlimited power. But the courts have never scrutinized these matters on the facts to find a more or less connection, and Lopez and Morrison didn't do that either. Lopez adopted a categorical distinction beyond which Congress could not go. It did not go into the more or less necessity of it. And in Morrison, they rejected Congress's assessment of more or less necessity and insisted on its categorical distinction. Okay, so that's step one. Now, there's a theory, and you know, somewhat, I'm debating Orrin, but in fact, there is a government arguing this case. And the government is arguing under this essential to a broader regulatory scheme theory that has never been adopted by a majority of the court. I predict it will be adopted by a majority of the court someday. But when it is, it too will have to have a constraint. And you have to ask yourself, will it be a more or less necessity kind of constraint of the kind you're suggesting? I think that in the history of this country since McCulloch, the court has declined to get into that kind of inquiry. Or will it be a categorical kind of distinction? And if it is a categorical distinction, I think the fact that Justice Scalia uses the word activity 42 times in his opinion, provides an easy explanation for what the limitation is. You can reach non-economic intrastate activity if doing so is essential to a broader regulatory scheme, but you cannot mandate activity from inactivity. And that would be a line that I believe both he would be comfortable with and the court would be comfortable with. And the reason being is that if you draw that line, there is only one law that would be affected by that line, because there's only one time Congress has ever tried to exercise this power, and that is this law.
Eugene, just to follow up, do you mean to argue that Congress could ban loafing or require exercise?
Interesting question whether the power to raise armies could be seen as necessary and proper. That's the kind of argument I think you could see. But if you were to say it's necessary and proper for Commerce Clause reasons, I think, and this is how I read the distinction the court was trying to draw, perhaps the distinction that Kennedy bought onto, because he was the swing vote, setting aside Scalia's concurrence in Raich, is that the connection has to be a little more plausible than for that. I think that's got to be the way. If you have to step back afterwards and reconcile Raich and Lopez and Morrison,
in Raich, the court did not reject the economic, non-economic distinction. It purported to adhere to it in reliance on a 1966 dictionary, Webster's dictionary definition of what economic means, which if we'd been litigating the case, realized that was going to be dispositive, we might have looked at other dictionaries. But we didn't know that was what the court was going to be relying on. But what this is actually, that's kind of a joke. I'm actually grateful that the court did it that way, because the government had a theory very much like Orrin's that they argued vociferously in their briefs and in oral argument, which Justice Stevens had expressed some skepticism of in oral argument. And that is that it's economic if someone does something that they could have done on the market. If they refrain from going into the marketplace, because that of the effect that that has on the marketplace, the failure to go into the marketplace, in other words, to do it themselves, is economic. That's an argument the government made. I think it was based on a kind of a law professor's reading of Wickard that doesn't actually supported by Wickard itself. And even though they argued that quite forcefully in oral argument, Paul Clement did. It was rejected. It was not adopted by the court, because and that was the only time I got the court off my back during oral argument. I mean, they were coming down on me very hard that day, and Justice Souter especially was coming down on me very hard on this point. And he kept pressing the matter, and then I said, if just because marital sex is a substitute for something that you can get on the market does not make marital sex an economic activity. And there was this long pause. The only such pause during my 30 minutes. And Justice Breyer jumped in and asked a question on a different subject. And then that argument was not accepted by the court. Instead of using the government's theory, they used the Webster's Dictionary theory. And I believe that this is the functional equivalent of the argument, or some of what Oregon says is the functional equivalent of the argument the government made in Raich, in which the court did not accept. And Justice Kennedy, and for all we know, it's because Justice Kennedy would not join a majority opinion with that theory in it, for all we know.
Question over there.
I'm curious about, Oren keeps saying the activity-non-activity distinction, and yet he cites to the omission problem in criminal law. The Supreme Court decision that comes to my mind immediately, although not a Commerce Clause case, that relies heavily on this is Glucksberg. Why would, with physician-assisted suicide and the distinction between the state's ability to reach active activity and the omission, the failure to provide care, why would that not provide some guidance in this?
Is that for me or for Randy?
I deem it for you, Oren.
I think I last read Glucksberg like several years ago, so I'd have to reread it to really answer the question fairly, to be totally candid.
It has to do.
Well, then they should be cited in the challenge. I mean, I'd have to reread.
Well,
it,
if the government chose to question the meaningfulness of the act omission distinction, then you would look at a case like Glucksberg to say that there's a big difference between killing somebody by injecting a lethal chemical into them in the form of assisted suicide and simply allowing them to expire by not rescuing them and by not giving them more medical services, which is the line that the Supreme Court draw. On one side, it's permissible. On the other side, it's not. So that if the government were to question the meaningfulness of the act omission distinction or the activity-inactivity distinction, so far they're not doing that. So far they're simply saying this is activity, number one, in various ways. But even that wasn't something that the judge in Michigan, Judge Stee in Michigan, accepted when he upheld the law. He said that they believed that the plaintiffs were misreading the precedent as limited to activity when, in fact, the Congress's power extends to economic decisions. So the government's arguing that a decision is a form of activity, but the judge said he can go to decisions in addition to activity. So the government has had like three or four different or five different ways of conceiving of why this is permissible. And by the way, one of them may work. I'm not saying it won't. But if there's three or four or five different ways of trying to figure out how to argue it and they can't quite figure out, the last one they did in oral argument was this is actually a financing mechanism. That's a new one they've come up with. So if there's four or five different ways to try to figure out why this comes under existing doctrine, it is not an open and shut case. Let's just put it that way.
And back. Yeah.
I think the activity-non-activity distinction runs through the common law of torts, but I had a specific response to Oren that I thought was better than Randy's, and that is that when you make a law saying that if you buy aspirin, you must buy health insurance, the purpose of that law is not to regulate the activity of buying aspirin. It's to regulate the inactivity of not having health insurance. So that you have to ask, what is the purpose? What is being regulated, and what's being regulated is an aspirin. So that's a case where you are trying to pretend to regulate an activity when the transparent purpose is to regulate an inactivity.
And David, that is connected to Richard's point on unconstitutional conditions. Your point is very fundamental, and I thought of it, and I just didn't mention it, and I appreciate the fact that you have. But it is related to a constitutional doctrine of unconstitutional conditions, which is what you're describing.
Yep. Right.
Yes. Way back.
Randy, I want to press the issue. I think the reason they didn't do it the tax route is more than just policy, although politically that's why they didn't do it. But I think there's also a constitutional dimension to that. And if you look at this in contrast with Social Security, Social Security, whatever its lack of constitutional merit, it's at least tied to an income tax, which is authorized. This one would not have been tied to an income tax, and it's clearly not an excise tax. The best we could get is that it would be a direct tax if they had tried to do this through the tax route. And it's not apportioned according to population if you end up with that. And it would be a violation of another constitutional provision. So I think there, I mean, that may be sufficient to distinguish the Social Security case on a tax ground. Where, otherwise, it's like, well, we forced you to buy a life insurance annuity, and here we're forcing you to buy a health insurance annuity. What's the difference? And I think that it's the tax hook that does provide a difference.
John, I think you're right about that. But what I was really, and I may have just spoke, I may have moved too quickly. It's not that they could have simply relabeled this a tax and it would then have been okay. I think there's lots of reasons to think that that would, it's the substance, not only the form, that was not observed here. It's only that they could have done a Medicare system for everybody, if that would have been within their power to do. If Medicare is constitutional, then Medicare for everyone is constitutional under the tax power. That's the only thing I'm saying, that there is a constitutional way in which they can. Taxes are the way in which a lot of these free rider problems are supposedly solved. Of course, we know they create all kinds of other problems. So that's all. So you're right. But let me just say something for those of you, so you don't get too distracted by this tax power argument. And that is, I don't think that this tax power argument is going anywhere for the government. And we're really talking, in some respects, Category 3 of terms of prediction. There's a reason why it's been rejected, even by courts that have upheld the mandate. And that is that if it were recognized in this present form, it would give Congress the power, again, an unprecedented power, to order American citizens to do anything, refrain or do anything, so long as they limited the penalty to a financial one, a monetary penalty enforced by the IRS. That would be an unprecedented claim of power that's never existed before. And the reason why I predict it's not going to go anywhere is because if there are five justices who want to uphold the mandate, they have all of this economic activity, decisions, rubric, one of those theories the government has come up with, they'll choose one of those. Justice Breyer will write the opinion. It'll be Commerce Clause, Necessary and Proper Clause. It'll be very much like the argument that Orrin made earlier in his initial opening statement. And they won't want to go the tax power route. On the other hand, if they don't buy that argument for whatever reason, because they want to strike it down, those justices will not then be persuaded by the tax power argument to change their mind and go, oh, well, we must uphold it because of the tax power. Therefore, I conclude, the tax power argument is just a distraction. And it's, so far, it's not distracting the courts, and I predict it won't distract the courts.
In the back.
Yeah, for Randy. I want to suggest that actually there are hundreds of statutes that are similar to this one. And essentially the structure of this statute is if you don't buy insurance, you pay a little bit higher tax, $695. So, for example, if you don't make a contribution to charity this year, you also pay higher taxes. And for that matter, if you don't acquire health insurance through your employer under Section 106 of the tax code, again, you'll pay higher taxes. So, and this is not a picayune point, right? The point is that there's no difference between a subsidy to do something and a penalty on not doing it, at least economically. And I suppose the difference that we can point to in this statute is it's labeled a penalty. So then I guess what I want to hear is, why is it that the entire content of the Commerce Clause turns on the words that Congress uses to describe the incentive that they're providing?
What did what you have to say before have anything to do with the Commerce Clause?
Well, it's
I didn't hear any reference to the Commerce Clause until the very end, so I just want to, so you kind of threw me.
Sure, it's not necessarily just taxes, right? There are benefits that married couples get under federal law, and therefore there's a penalty on failing to marry under federal law, right? I assume that some of those benefits are conferred under some kind of commerce theory.
No.
So are you suggesting that all of those incentives for anything under federal law or unconstitutional on your theory of distinctions between actions and inactions?
No, as you well know, I've written about the tax power argument. I've already said why I think the tax power argument is not going to work, as have you. And so you have to either do form or you have to do substance. And so there's two ways to go. First of all, in the measure is not called a tax. It's called a penalty. It's located in the Internal Revenue Code, but it's not called a tax. There are other measures in the bill called excise taxes. This isn't one of them. The definition of a tax, the substantive definition of a tax, is it must have a revenue-raising purpose. So the question is, does this have a revenue-raising purpose? The Act contains a separate section which identifies all the revenue-raising provisions of the Act, and it was very important that Congress get that right because that's how the cost of the Act was scored in order to bring the cost of the Act under a $1 trillion magic line, which was somehow politically salient. And the penalty, the revenue collected from the penalty, was not listed among the revenue-raising provisions of the bill. All right, so there's that. There's the substance of the there's the substantive distinction between penalties and taxes that the court has used when they've refused to accept the label of tax, and they say, they look behind the label of tax and say it's really a penalty, and that is the general purpose to raise funds, is that's why it was enacted, and it has a and we're not going to look at whether it has a regulatory impact, or is this really a sanction for the failure to perform a legal obligation? Well, look at the statute and see what it says, and that's what it says. Finally, I would say that the mandate and the mandate that says you have to buy insurance is separate from the penalty. So the question is, what is the authority for the mandate? And then if there is no authority for the mandate, then the penalty never operates. The penalty is simply, there's nothing for it to penalize if the mandate is itself unconstitutional and it has to be justified. So in the case law, the courts have said that when Congress says that something's a tax, we will not look behind the label of tax because to see if it has a regulatory purpose. That's what it says. By the same token, there is no cases that say when Congress specifically identifies something as a regulation of commerce, and all 8 findings, by the way, in the statute are about the regulation of commerce. None of them are about the raising of revenue. There's no case that's ever said that that the court will look behind a statute that is couched as a regulation of commerce and say, could Congress have passed this if they had exercised their tax power? Why? Why? The reason is because the constraint on the tax power is political. And in order to, if you're going to say, as people who defend that power say, that the constraint on that tax power is political, then it has to be identified to the public so the public can object to it. And in fact, there were tax bills, versions of this bill that existed at the time, and Congress chose not to enact them. Why not? Because of politics. That's why not. And they decided to do it this backdoor way instead. And that has consequences. Just because they can do it one way doesn't mean they can do it any other way. It may be more politically advantageous for them to do. There's no such constitutional principle.
Gene Meyer.
I wanted to pick up on Eugene's point, because it seems to me that's where things may end up coming out. I'm interested in what both Randy and Oren think about this idea of, well, you can only go, we're not going to go to any of these extremes, but we are, but the court is going to go, be willing to go a certain way, and is what Eugene's saying, is that farther than the court plausibly would be likely to go under previous doctrine? Or maybe to make it slightly clearer, I mean, the essence of what Eugene's saying, I think, is, look, whatever the arguments are, all these other logical extensions, the court's just going to say, that's too much. Is that how it's going to be looked at? And if it is looked at that way, is the court likely to say, this too is too much?
I mean, my own sense of this is that the court is likely to look at this as very much an economic issue that is pretty clearly on the line of what is permissible, and will continue to stick to that economic, non-economic distinction drawn in Lopez. And if I had to guess, I would guess that Justice Kennedy gets his discussion of in his Lopez concurrence inserted into the majority opinion, assuming the court takes the individual mandate case. So I think this will be seen as pretty clearly something economic. It's about buying and selling and healthcare markets and these markets that the justices are just not going to understand themselves. They have no idea how any of this stuff works. So so that's my guess. And then they'll say other things are gonna be outside this power, but we'll deal with those.
I don't really completely disagree with that. I do think that that is that, first of all, even if that isn't the way it ends up, I mean, I do think that's the way it will start off. That is, I think that's the mindset that a lot of justices will have in the beginning when they first hear about this case, probably already have had that reaction. This is economic, under the New Deal settlement, Congress has power over the economy, this is economic, what's the problem? I mean, that's sort of the starting point, I think. But then, so I sort of agree with that. And I think at the end of the day, if they uphold the law, if there's 5 votes to uphold the law, then it will be something like that as the rationale. But, and this gets away a little bit from the, you know, talking a lot about economic activity and inactivity, which I think is important, obviously. But it's the power to impose economic mandates, just to stay within the economic realm. does Congress, this is a power Congress has never exercised before, does Congress have the power under its regulatory powers, not its tax powers, under the regulatory powers, does it have a power to impose economic mandates? And I, and given that it's never been done before, and they have other ways, they've always found other ways of doing what they've wanted to do within their powers, if this bill remains unpopular, and if the political situation, well, let me just talk a little bit about the politics for a minute, because I said that in my talk, and the politics matter. If this bill were really, really popular, if the American people widely supported it, if it would have been enacted with bipartisan support, I don't think this challenge would have gone very far. Even though I have good arguments on my side, I don't think they would have had legal traction. And it's not because I think the court just does what's political. I think that, but the political context does dictate what the parameters of what the court might be willing to do and not willing to do. And so a lot depends on whether this bill is deemed to be overwhelmingly popular. But this is the first major piece of social legislation that affects every man, woman, and child in this country that was passed on a straight-line party vote with no bipartisan support and a bare majority and under shady, you know, legislative circumstances with all kinds of warnings to the Congress that this was not a welcome piece of legislation beginning with Scott Brown's election and et cetera. And we all know the story. Under those circumstances, when I started this, when this argument began, I said that if this legislation turns out to be very popular, then we'd have a tough row to hoe in terms of getting five justices. But on the other hand, supposing I hypothesize that one or both houses of Congress change parties as a result of this, I hypothesize. Well, one of those acts, that things happen. Suppose that, and suppose the court, I could go on and on. I won't because we have time constraints. But so a lot will depend on how the justices perceive this law and how they perceive, I mean, it'll a lot depend on whether President Obama is reelected in 2012 or not and under what circumstances and the way that campaign goes. This is all Category 3 of constitutionality, getting to five votes. Now, which I think is a legitimate way of looking at constitutional questions, as long as we know that that's what we're talking about. Now, Category 3, the political valence, getting to five votes, will also be influenced by the doctrinal terrain, such that no matter how unpopular the vote, the bill is, the Southeastern Underwriters is not in play. However, given the tenuous, you've already told, even if you accept most everything that Lauren says, you can already see this is a mess. I mean, this is not a gimme case. Either way, under those circumstances, the justices have a doctrinal out that can be justified as I have done, and I think there's every reason to believe they'll take it.
10-second response.
I think it's often the case that the politics of a big issue can have an impact on where the court goes, much less likely in an area like this where most of the key justices have already thought through their views. Many of them have published their views, and they're likely to stick to their ground. And the short-term politics, I think, are going to have a much lesser impact on where the justices go in this sort of a case than in other sorts of cases.
Well, maybe if the court upholds this law, Congress will be able to require everyone to buy a copy of Friedrich von Hayek's The Road to Serfdom.
Ironic.
On that note, let's thank our panelists.
Great.